Welcome to Safe in Our Arms, a WSKG News special. I'm Crystal Sirakis. This is a show about guns, but not about gun control laws. There's been a lot of talk about gun control already, and it seems agreement there is pretty far off. But maybe there are ways to make guns safer without restricting them. Any consensus starts with talking, with a conversation. That's a hard thing to do when it comes to guns, according to Dr. Harry Wilson. He's the author of Guns, Gun Control, and Elections, The Politics and Policy of Firearms. Wilson says the logjam over guns relates to political polarization in general.
What we see is people almost essentially living in different worlds, that people living in one world view firearms from one perspective, and people living in the other world on the other side view firearms in a completely different way. One side sees them essentially as weapons of destruction, and the other side essentially sees them as tools and, in some cases, forms of recreation.
It also seems that when we have these conversations around guns, it almost always follows in the wake of some sort of tragic event like a mass shooting. So are the conversations that happen in the wake of this just too emotional sometimes?
Well, I think we see those conversations because that's when the policy window is really open for supporters of stricter gun laws. We know from policymaking and theories of policymaking that those windows of opportunity don't stay open for very long periods of time, and they usually follow an event that focuses everyone's attention on that issue. And clearly and sadly, mass shootings do that for gun control. In periods where we don't see those events, then public opinion generally starts moving in favor of gun rights, and those who advocate for stricter gun laws are just not likely to win any political battles.
Do you think that we focus too much on mass shootings when it comes to the greater context of talking about guns and how to make these safer in our communities?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. And I think that's one area where certainly at least researchers on both sides of the issue, I think, would tend to agree with that, that we focus far too much on mass shootings. And it's understandable why we do that, because they're so grotesque and because they're much more likely to be in the news than, for lack of a better term, a run-of-the-mill murder, run-of-the-mill homicide. So we spend much more time looking at those. But in reality, those events, very fortunately for us as a society, are extremely uncommon, and they constitute a very small percentage of homicides in general and constitute an extremely small percentage of firearm-related homicides.
Many policy experts agree that the policies or legislation that's proposed in the wake of these mass shootings and that policy window that you talked about would actually have little to no impact on preventing another mass shooting. So are there things that would reduce the risk of these horrific events?
The mass shootings are really are very difficult to prevent. People don't like to talk about that, and people don't like to admit it, but they're very difficult to prevent. And what that means is if you don't know who, or you sort of don't know how, and you don't know when, how do you try to prevent that from happening? By most estimates today, even if one wanted to restrict AR-style rifles, which is of questionable value, I would argue, but even if one wanted to do that, most estimates are there are somewhere between 7 and 10 million of those out there now, maybe even more than that. How do you begin to get those back? You can't. When we've enacted laws such as this, they have all been prospective. They've all been going out into the future and restricting future sales. But that means that all these weapons are out there and essentially already available.
Well, if we're talking about how hard it is to prevent mass shootings, let's talk about gun violence in general. Are there things that communities or policy could do that would reduce the risk of gun violence in general?
I think even that, sadly, it's extremely difficult to do. There are things we can do. We can, and these are going to be perhaps minimally useful, minimal impact, but minimal impact is better than no impact. I think education is very useful in this regard. We talk about passing, and many states have passed child safety laws and ammunition storage laws and things like that. But the reality is, in the privacy of one's home, those laws are no more effective than laws restricting types of sexual behavior between individuals in their own home, which is to say, they're completely and totally ineffective. We've never been able to legislate common sense, and we never will be able to legislate common sense. We certainly do have for background checks now for through FFLs, federal firearms licensees. People have to go through a background check. That does prevent some people from buying firearms. There certainly is the argument that they can get them elsewhere if they want to. And there's still the old argument that if you really want to do harm to another person, you will find a way to do that, whether one can procure a firearm or one can't.
Well, one of the things that it seems everybody is on board with is improving mental health care systems to prevent gun violence and, I think, by extension, violence in general. Have there been successful programs or policies that have done that?
I'm not sure about the answer specifically to that question about how effective they are. I mean, what I can say is I don't think that there is a downside to improved mental health policies. So I think most people agree that this is, gun rights supporters are not opposed to policies that would improve mental health. They're opposed to some policies, as we saw most recently with the Obama executive order, restricting firearms among older Americans who had in some way been found or requiring help with their financial transactions. The argument was that, well, these people may be mentally unstable. They've been unfit in this regard, so we should take their firearms as well. Gun rights groups offered very strong opposition to that, and that executive order has been undone by President Trump. But the argument there was these people are having their rights taken away from them without due process or anything else, because someone is having difficulty adding up numbers does not mean they've become violent in some way, shape, or form. So there are always going to be some of those disagreements. But I think in general, improving mental health services, no one's opposed to that. So there are some things that we can do, but honestly, these are all going to be, around the edges. And one thing we do need to bear in mind in the overarching conversation of all this, we've seen a 20-plus year decline in homicides in the United States and in general in violent crime, even through a recession when criminologists and, I'll say, so-called experts such as myself would have predicted an increase in homicides and an increase in violent crime. And we've seen decreases. That trend, in fairness, has leveled off. And in some major cities last year, we did see some increases in the past year or two. We've seen increases in homicides. And people are now beginning to think maybe we are at the end of this. But the homicide rate in the United States is nothing compared to what it was in the late 80s and early 1990s.
I want to shift tracks a little bit and talk about the role that education plays in helping to make guns safer in a household or in a community. One of the stories that I found interesting in my research was Eddie the Eagle, which was a pretty straightforward program that is still used in some parts of the country where you have this character, and I think the program is geared more toward young children, where it's simply, if you see a gun, leave it alone, go find an adult. But even that was a little bit controversial. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. That was controversial because people argued what the argument that some gun control advocates made was essentially likening Eddie Eagle to Joe Camel. And, while Joe Camel was a cartoon character, in some sense, Joe Camel was also promoting the smoking of cigarettes. They said Eddie Eagle is still promoting firearms and firearm usage, even though the message is, and the message clearly in all of that campaign was and still is, right, if you see a gun, back away, don't touch it, call an adult. I don't think anyone can disagree with that message. But the argument was, well, they're doing this with an attractive cartoon character. Therefore, essentially, the subliminal message, if you will, for children is guns are fun, guns are cool, and it's okay for you to play with guns. I would take the educational campaign at face value, and I believe that the intent of the NRA there was not to inculcate a young cohort of shooters, if you will, but it was to teach gun safety. Now, some of their other shooting programs for youth clearly are, those are aimed at, and they also emphasize safety, by the way, but those are clearly aimed at increasing the number of younger people who engage in the shooting sports and potential firearms owners in the future. But those are clearly geared in that direction. And Eddie Eagle, I would argue, was not. But I think that also gets to sort of that one side really doesn't talk to the other.
So we don't talk about it. And it's clear that people disagree on this issue. So maybe it's best that we don't talk about it at all?
I'm not sure that it's best that we don't talk about it at all. I think what we need to try to do, and this is very difficult, but we need to try to find some common language to use, and we need to try to find a way of putting ourselves in the position of the other person. For example, in the state of New York, guns are seen very differently, and support for gun control and views of firearms are very different in New York City than they are in upstate New York. And that's for very obvious reasons, because guns mean very different things in New York City than they do in upstate New York. People need to sort of understand that, but people need to understand also that there are folks that live in other areas. And I think what we sort of encounter more often than not is that everyone looks at it from their own perspective, and no one ever looks at it from the other person's perspective and says, oh, somebody might be able to look at these things in a different way than I do. What both sides seem intent on doing is convincing the other side that they are wrong. And one thing I think we clearly demonstrate on all political issues is the more strongly I try to convince you that you are wrong, the more likely you are to dig in your heels and to be convinced that, in fact, you are correct and that I'm the one that's wrong. That's not persuasive. Persuasion is actually sitting down and trying to talk to people and saying, okay, what can we do about this? Tell me about your perspective and let me tell you about my perspective. And let's see if there's someplace we can sort of meet here. Maybe there isn't. But the worst thing that happens there is you become familiar with someone else's perspective.
Well, if we want to talk about this dialogue and seeing it from the other person's side, does this happen in the state houses or does it first happen in the living room and somebody saying, you know, hey, I'm uncomfortable that you want to take my guns away. And the other person saying, I'm uncomfortable that you're going out fully armed and kitted out at the restaurant.
I think it can happen in either place. Right now, it's not happening in either place. There's a debate within political science, whether sort of the political polarization that we see today really originated with elected officials, primarily Congress, or if it originated with citizens. I'm not sure that chicken and egg question really makes much of a difference. The reality is that we see political polarization, certainly on gun control policy, but on a variety of other issues as well. And we see that at all levels today. And I think anyone can try to break through that gridlock, although it's very difficult. Many people would argue elected officials should lead the way on that. I can't disagree with it, but I do know that elected officials on both sides of the aisle today get punished if they try to do that. One of the things that I found in some of my research about firearms is that it isn't really just, we talk about the differences between gun owners and people who don't own guns, particularly in public opinion, and those are very big differences. But one of the differences there also is simply familiarity with firearms. It is not only a function of do I own a firearm or do I go shooting, but it's a function of, are any of those firearms in my household? Do I know people who own guns? Do I know people who hunt, or do I know people who go to a shooting range? And if the answer to that is yes, then people are much less likely to be fearful of firearms, and frankly, they're much less likely to support stricter gun laws.
Do you see a path forward on this issue?
There's not a clear path forward, no, I don't think. But again, I would liken that, I would say this is symptomatic of the greater political polarization that we see in the country. Because if you ask me right now, do I see a path forward on a wide variety of other issues in the country, my answer would also be no.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot of work to do as a country and a society.
Yeah, sadly, it sounds like I'm not a very optimistic person. I apologize for that. I'd like to think that I'm relatively optimistic. And if people, I think it is possible, but it is just extremely difficult. Often we don't even know people on the other side to talk to.
Well, Dr. Wilson, thank you for talking with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Harry Wilson is director for the Institute of Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College in Virginia.